It's time for teacher educators to stand up and resist privatization. But how? We have a plan. We also have Alfie Cohn and Matt Damon's mom. Let's bust some pencils.
This is Busted Pencils Radio, fully leaded education talk with Dr. Tim Slecker. Here's what's trending in education news.
From the Washington Post, why are teachers in Europe paid so much better than those in the United States? From Berlin, midterm elections have rarely captivated Americans' attention, but this year's elections are shaping up to be different. Voter enthusiasm has spiked following the polarizing Supreme Court confirmation process for Brett M. Kavanaugh. Outside the nation's capital, however, other issues have raised the stakes of the upcoming vote. Education may not be featured across cable news 24/7, but a wave of teacher strikes this year has put a spotlight on education funding in many states. Cut it more or raise it? Disagreement about that question has motivated a growing number of teachers to run for office and has dealt several blows to Republican contenders. But to observers in Europe, the mere existence of the U.S. debate has appeared rather strange at times, if not downright tragic.
Why?
And for them to look at it and go, are you bloke serious?
whatever accent you want, you know, insert European accent. I don't know which one I could put on right now. Yeah. Right, but they're looking at us and saying, education funding, like,
why is that a problem?
Teachers are getting elected and knocking people who are against funding, you know, and they're like, yeah. And in fact, it really boils down to, when you get into this, the pay teachers receive and the comparison pay of teachers in Europe.
It's crazy.
It's insane, right?
Yeah.
I mean, we really look at this. We were talking about, I mean, first of all, in Germany, right? They put this out there. In Germany, if you're a teacher, you're paid in the same category as medical doctors.
Right.
Okay? Think about that. Who then goes into teaching?
Really good people.
Okay, right. So the idea that, you know, you don't have to pay teachers well. We just don't want to do that in America. And then we scream, the education system's failing. It's falling apart. Students are disastrous. It's like, well, what are you going to do, people? Or I should say, when I say people, insert politician.
Right.
Because, you know, it's just, because every time there's something wrong with American education, it's a politician's fault. It just is. And so here we have, though, teachers running for office, like they say, knocking people out to try to move this because the pay is so dismal. In fact, we pointed out, if in this article in the Washington Post, there's a really great graph of all of the countries that beat America. Luxembourg. Okay?
We love Luxembourg.
Now, I said maybe it's because they only have two teachers in the whole country, and so it's not, you know, it's real. But seriously, look at the Poland, Denmark, Belgium, Norway, you know, all these countries.
Yeah. Yep.
Why is it? Now, people will say, well, you know, maybe back to the original story. Well, you know, they've got a little bit of socialism over there. And their taxes are so high. And, well, it's like, okay, yeah, you pay taxes, you pay for your teachers. You don't pay taxes. You don't pay for your teachers. You don't pay for your teachers. You get crappy students. You pay for your teachers. You get awesome students.
Right.
Okay. So what are we going to do, people? I think it's time for a trip to Europe.
From Curmudgeonation in Pennsylvania, testing good news and bad news. The good news, students will now have a very broad range of methods for proving they are diploma worthy. The bad news, the no-stakes, meaningless, nothing tests will still be used to evaluate teachers and schools.
We'll talk about some kind of good news, bad news, truly.
Way to go, kids.
I love Curmudgeonation. We typically don't do news, but Peter Green has been on the show as a guest before.
Mm-hmm.
But this is this kind of fight against high-stakes tests here. And my old home state in Pennsylvania put out these things called the Keystone tests.
Okay.
Now, 6-7 years ago now, they were proposing them. And these were going to be graduation requirements. You had to pass these tests.
Okay.
It's taken up to this time and people have been, you know, we need it for this and we need it for that and you can't use it for that and you can use it for this. And it's just this big debacle. So here we are now going, guess what? The good news, finally people have said, we're not going to take students and not let them graduate based on the Keystone tests. They have other ways. They have in-class assignments. They have portfolios. In fact, they have the ways that you and I probably graduated from high school, which is getting passing grades.
Right. Yes, without these tests. Yep.
Right. So we're going back to the old passing grades method in Pennsylvania. Awesome.
Way to go, kids.
Right. But are the Keystone tests going away? No. Kids are still going to take them, and the scores are going to be used to measure teachers in schools.
Perfect.
Wonderful.
Sounds
so
great.
Now kids who have no incentive to do well at all. Right?
Right. That's true.
Okay, so you and I are sitting there. We're taking this test, and we're like, I don't give a
matter.
I already got my A in chemistry.
Right.
I'm out of here. I've been accepted to, you know, Harvard or where I went to Edinburgh, you know, State College, of course, which is all it would take me. But I graduated, right?
Right, you did.
Okay, I graduated. My teacher. But so we're goofing off. We don't care.
It doesn't matter. You're going to graduate anyway.
But my chemistry or my teachers are sitting there going, Slacker, I need you to focus on this test because I'm going to be fired if you fail. So teachers get fired, students pass and go to college. This is an awesome system. Only politicians would design and think,
right.
Hey, this is workable.
We're exactly.
Right? A high-stakes test, not for kids, but for teachers in schools. Think, I mean, really, does this make sense to you?
It doesn't at all, because then how do you know kids aren't going to want to take it out on their teacher? Or, you know, I don't like my teacher. They gave me a B instead of an A, or I'm going to do this to them.
Right.
They know what these rules are now.
This is... when educators leave the room and politicians enter, this is the kind of crap you get.
From edweek.org, Betsy DeVos, lack of civics education draws students to ideas like socialism. The U.S. Secretary of Education, Betsy DeVos, said that socialism may be on the rise among young voters because they aren't getting a strong foundation in civics and government at the K through 12 level.
Well, there you, once again, Betsy, our wonderful education secretary, I'll give her credit for at least using the word may.
Yes.
Okay.
She hasn't said it's the
not
actual
direct,
effect.
Okay, but there is cause and effect implied in her statement.
Yes.
So this creepy socialism, which every good American knows, is not something you want to dabble in because it's kind of, it's like witchcraft. I mean, stuff happens. Start messing around with socialism.
Right.
So, but there's a rise of people asking questions, talking about it. There's a couple people who've ran as Democratic socialists.
Ooh.
And have been elected.
Mm-hmm.
So therefore, it must be the fact that schools are not doing their job teaching civics and government. And I'm kind of confused by this because in my civics and in my government classes, we actually did learn about socialism. We learned about communism. We learned about capitalism. We learned about representative democracy, majority democracy, and all those things, right?
Mm-hmm.
So that was what was supposed to be taught. What it sounds to me like Miss Betsy is saying is that hardcore American capitalism, y'all, ain't being taught anymore. And then the damn socialists are taking over.
They're just coming out of nowhere.
Coming out of the woodwork. Well, everybody knows that public schools is a socialist institution that indoctrinates K-12 kids into socialism, if not communism.
I didn't realize that. Wow. See, we learn something new every day.
Well, some have said. No, seriously, some on the side, and whatever side, that Betsy's side, critics of public schools, some of their criticism has been the fact that we don't like public schools from the whole idea that they are, in fact, socialist institutions. They are paid for by the government, right?
Mm-hmm.
You know, and people would like to get rid of them. And so this, coming from Betsy, though, that socialism is on the rise, and the cause may be lack of civics, lack of American government. Mm-hmm. I don't know how you get there to make those two leaps. And I'm not sure, really, I haven't seen the research that shows demonstrably that socialism in America is on the rise. The last time I checked, there were tons of billionaires. Actually, there were a minutia of billionaires, and there were still like a ton of poor people, which indicates to me capitalism is doing well.
We are Busting Pencils!
Hey, this is Tim from Rise Against here on Busted Pencils Radio.
She's a social studies scholar, women's studies teacher and advocate, and educational historian. She is the current chairperson of the Department of Teacher Education at Michigan State University. She is also the author of Professional Preparation, Principled Responses to an Ethos of Privatization in Teacher Education, a chapter in the new book, Principled Resistance, How Teachers Resolve Ethical Dilemmas. Welcome to Busted Pencils, Professor Margaret Smith Crocco.
Thanks so much, Tim. It's great to be with you.
Well, that's a lot of stuff there going on. I mean, holy cow. We try to say on Busted Pencils, we stay away from the jargon, but I was like, let's put it in an ethos of privatization, principled resistance. What are we going to do with this? No, this is great. It's teacher education. We spent a lot of time talking to teachers, but this idea here in your book chapter just caught my eye. And I'm amazed, though, too, that you were able to find Busted Pencils and put it in your chapter.
Yeah, you're pretty famous.
Infamous.
In certain circles where we are concerned with things like resistance and the future of teaching and teacher education. And remember, I did 20 years in New York before coming to the Midwest. So we've got a lot of activist teachers and teacher educators there. So this is part of my way of being in the work of teacher education, to know groups like, know enterprises like yours, yeah. Which are important for our teachers and teacher education force these days, heaven knows.
Well, thank you so much for that. I mean, we are trying to make a difference here and get the message out. And like I said, we typically talk to teachers and the resistance they're going forward. But, this is really refreshing because being the dean, the way I actually pay the bills, being the dean of a school of education and a teacher educator, and of course, a social studies scholar like yourself, coming back and now bringing teacher education, because, I think this is part of the missing resistance that people, we need to build even more. And so, we're going to talk about this in your chapter. But just to kind of set the stage, though, I mean, teachers are resisting, and you call this an ethos of privatization. Let's just kind of clear that up for a listener. What do you mean privatization?
Yeah, I know it's a mouthful, for sure, but what I was trying to do was capture a concept of a long history of change in our profession. I mean, you can go back to A Nation at Risk in the 1980s, which hit the educational policy world at a time where there were also some shifts politically in the nation, and I think views were changing about the public sector versus the private sector. There came to be known or believed, I think it's more of a faith statement than anything, that the private sector always operated in a superior way to the public sector. You have that kind of growing set of beliefs, and The Nation at Risk launches this strong critique of public schools and how public education is failing our students and putting us in a globalizing world in a disadvantaged position. And with that, we begin to see a set of reforms that are, and this is across different professions and industries, that think that the market, market-based reform is the way that things should go, so that you have more private and less public. Kind of conversations across multiple industries, but especially in teaching, around issues of accountability and standardization and efficiency, market-based values. And I think that has just accelerated over the last 20, 30 years to the point where in some quarters it's just taken as conventional wisdom. And so this notion of privatization and taking things out of the government, the federal government, or the government at the state levels, taking those kind of public goods out and shifting them, putting them in the hands of private agents, will improve the quality of the product. And so I think that's what we've seen. We've seen it happen with public schools. We're certainly seeing it happen with teacher education, as you know.
Right. And so, I mean, you put that there, A Nation at Risk, 1983, so well over 30 years ago. And, you know, I mean, this is what where we're at now, though. The effect of 30 years of moving towards privatization, and, you know, we lay this out through standardization, the idea that the market is going to make failing schools, which, of course, was nonsense to begin with, the metric that actually there was no real metric in A Nation at Risk. It was
right.
just a persuasive, a bad persuasive paper. But it really moved people in this direction to the point, though, now that, you know, where does school choice come out? Vouchers, charters, all of these things, these ideas that have truly disrupted the American public school system to the point where we have teachers at an all-time morale low leaving the place. But then this is where I really want to come to your work, because what about the teacher educators and those of us who are trying to prepare teachers? What's the effect of privatization on the work we do?
Yeah, well, I think the best example of this ethos of privatization in terms of teacher education was the creation of Teach for America, which posited that if you got very bright young college graduates to commit to several years of teaching in distressed places, urban but not exclusively urban, some rural places across the country, you know, the business model was essentially to keep them in those schools working for 1, 2, 3 years. They got minimal training, 5 or 6 weeks of training, very little emphasis on anything other than mechanics, a bit of lesson planning, teaching strategies, a wholly unintellectual approach to the creation of teachers, and then put them in these places that were supposed to fix schools that were in need of help, and the constant churn of that was somehow going to miraculously improve education in places where there was tremendous need. So that served as a business model for other programs like the New York Teaching Fellows Program, and kind of analogous approaches today we're seeing over the last few years, again, with its beginning in New York, the Relay Graduate School of Education, or other fast-track alternative certification programs that hold out the promise that you can take very bright, committed young people and give them very little teacher preparation, and somehow they're going to move into these schools, and this is really going to fix, and I use that word in quotation marks, fix the schools. But, you know, it's not just that. I mean, it's the privatization, this kind of disruptive business model that was brought to teacher education. But it's a host of other things that I think have been demoralizing for the work of teacher education. Some of it is the national zeitgeist, if you will, about teaching. There was, you're probably aware of this, a survey, there is a survey done annually by Phi Delta Kappa, and this year they noted in the annual survey, came out, I think, August or September, that 53% of parents would discourage their children from going into teaching. This is like a dagger in my heart. And so it's, you know, there's something going on more generally, as well as these alternative fast-track programs that I think do not bode well for the future of strong public education in this country. But I would draw a line between the kind of nation at risk and its harsh critique of schooling and where we're at today.
Right, here we are. And I've used this, and this is, you know, of course, I'm going to only interview people that agree with me. So, like, no, but, you know, I think other people forget. And so I say, like my neighbor, the general public, when they hear the critique, when you hear about teachers, the idea that teachers are being prepared quote, in alternative tracks, in private institutions, in, and they're not, institutions probably not even the right word, in private right. entities, the idea, I mean, that's not even fully known yet. I still think that more people, most people still assume teachers go to college, they get their degree in teaching, they student teach, and they become a teacher. And the reality is that no, this disruptive fast track model that you lay out is just on the rise moving forward. Here in my new state of Wisconsin, you know, I came out of Pennsylvania and Penn State, now I'm at a private college here in Wisconsin. But I mean, Wisconsin, we have actually elevated in one way the idea, and again, this comes from the Every Student Succeeds Act, which actually puts in there the mandate that we need to provide alternative tracks. But in Wisconsin, we said, hey, institutions of higher education, for-profit, non-profit, entities we now call them in Wisconsin, you all too can prepare teachers. And so this idea of who's preparing teachers is also questionable, or I'd like to get, you know, more people out there just realizing you might want to start asking where your teachers got their education or their quote fast track training, because there's a massive difference between the two. And I know that's a whole different show where we can talk about the virtues of what we do in teacher education. But it's just to put it out there again. So this privatization, it's not just the public school down the road that's competing with the private charter school. It's now teacher education and our declining enrollments for not because they're running off to fast track places, but because, as you pointed out, most people don't want their kids to be teachers. The idea, though, that we would create private and fast track alternatives when you can't even get people into teaching to begin with strikes me as insanity. Margaret, you've seen this, and in your chapter, particularly in the book, Principled Resistance, How Teachers Resolve Ethical Dilemmas, you give us three looks at three different states, New York, Iowa, and Michigan. So what's going on in New York first?
Well, you know, New York is in some ways a kind of a singular environment for looking at the history and practice of education today, because historically it has been a highly centralized state, one in which the Regents exams were given since sometime in the 19th century, where educational policy really does have a top-down quality to it. And so, you know, these impositions from Albany, in this case, then were matched in the last 20 years by the No Child Left Behind, and New York opted into the race for the top monies, and so John King was the commissioner of education there before he went on to be secretary of education under Obama. So, you know, you have this kind of unique policy environment, one that's very different than either New Jersey or Connecticut, which are more like the New England model of local control. And so it's also New York. I mean, mm-hmm. people were primed for resisting. And so you had a variety of faculty members at Teachers College and at the other institutions of higher ed who were just writing and pushing back and talking, because especially those of us in New York City, very concerned about the effects of these policies, teacher accountability measures on the students in K through 12 schools. So you get, you know, these organizations like the Badass Teachers Association and the opt-out program that I think, grew like wildfire. And, you know, here's a case where Facebook actually did something good, right. And circulated information, and people met, and people marched, and people wrote. And so there was a lot of stuff getting stirred up relatively early there. And I did some collaboration with a professor who was at Queens College, Arthur Costigan, writing about what the effect of these accountability measures were. You know, teachers in urban areas tend to, even well-trained, well-prepared, you know, often you see them leaving teaching within 3 or 5 years. Now, Arthur and I were both pleased that our well-prepared teachers stuck it out, but that was not necessarily the norm. And so with these new policy changes, you were seeing an aggravation of that kind of quick exiting of urban school teaching, at least, and kind of a fleeing to the suburbs, which wasn't a good thing.
But see, and that, you know, this is why I'm thankful for this chapter, because I think there's a relative, you know, sense of the opt-out movement. There's a relative sense of pushing back against high-stakes standardized tests. And I don't know that teacher educators have been mentioned as being part of that resistance. Now, I will admit that I think it should be much more magnified, but in New York, in fact, my first, I started at the SUNY system myself, you know, right, and when was it, 99, and saw a lot of this come through, and it was like, you know, I remember pushing teacher educators that I worked with, we marched on Albany, because that was when they were making the region some mandatory high-stakes graduation requirement when it hadn't been there at that point, but, you know, there you go, teacher educators working alongside teachers, and that's kind of a beautiful thing, working alongside parents, the idea that we're all working together. What about Iowa? What happened in Iowa?
You know, Iowa is a very, very different situation. First of all, you didn't have people hadn't even heard of the documentary movie Waiting for Superman. I mean, it was just so very different in the sense it was insulated from a lot of the things that were happening in the East and in other parts of the country. Very much what was interesting to me there was that there was a very strong Association of Colleges of Teacher Education that overall was affiliated with the American Association of Colleges of Teacher Education. But remember, this is a small state. I think the population is 3 million. And, you know, they're like Michigan, there were 30-something different schools of education in the state, but they got along really well, and they had come together in this IACTE. They met regularly. They supported each other. You know, I thought Iowa did a really clever thing with the Common Core. It came into the state. They looked at it. They rebranded it as the Iowa Core. They were told by then-Governor Branstad to come up with an alternative certification program. And because of these really good relationships, the three Regents universities, UNI, University of Northern Iowa, University of Iowa, and Iowa State, got together, and they came up with something that satisfied Branstad's need to say that he was doing something, which, you know, by the way, these chief state school officers under Republicans, and I'm sure the same is true under the Democrats, but they have a playbook. And one of the things about moving around, especially from Iowa to Michigan, is to see some of the same kinds of policies being introduced here in Michigan. But in Iowa, it was, I think, the solidarity with teachers, the strong sense of professional preparation. This was a state in which charter schools, I think there were maybe one or two in Des Moines, but it was inflicted in a way by some of the controversial stuff that was happening on the East Coast, and just good community, kind of community civics, and that sustained teacher educators in that state. But I think solidarity and a sense of common purpose really did help out in Iowa in dealing with some of the things that Branstad was trying to promote. It also helped, and I think this speaks to where we're at nationally, that there were quite a few former teachers and teacher educators who served in the Iowa State Legislature. So that sympathetic, receptive ear to things that, say, Governor Branstad was trying to promote, it really helped mitigate some of the worst of this accountability movement, standardization movement in the state of Iowa.
But it is interesting what you just said, though, about the playbook, right? There is a national playbook on privatization, whether it be privatization of school choice charters, privatization of teacher education through Teach for America, Relay graduate schools, and God knows now we have the American Board Certification for Teacher Education that advertises you can get your license in 6 months for $1,500. And if you do it on Black Friday, you can get a $200 discount even. Yeah, so that's a whole other discussion. Yes, American Board Certification for Teacher Education. And thankfully, here in Wisconsin, our wonderful playbook, Governor Walker, decided it would be a good idea to allow them to operate in the state of Wisconsin. But, you know, it is so to hear, though, that in Iowa, the same playbook was trying to be pushed, but the resistance there by the teacher education colleges, you know, coming together, that's a great story. And in fact, I think more teacher education institutions in other states might want to think about how we organize ourselves together, because I continue to see more and more of this coming. Now, let's jump, though. You're now at Michigan State. You are in the home of Miss Betsy.
Yeah. And, you know, perfect to talk about privatization. Connection to her, because so much of what she and the Family Foundation and her advocates and cronies have done in the state of Michigan when it comes to charter schools has been so damaging, especially in Detroit, where these for-profit charter schools and charter school management organizations have just done a terrible disservice to students in Detroit, where things really need some help for sure. You know, here we've had a history, even before I came, of Governor Engler, a Republican, followed by a Democrat, followed by a Republican, and probably all of your listeners know what went on in Flint, and, you know, all the many ways in which I would say a kind of ethos of privatization has operated across various sectors. You know, we have felt again, the sort of this mitigating influence of the higher education institutions in the state, because there was an effort a few years ago to establish a fast-track alternative program called the Michigan Teacher Corps, and probably not coincidentally, one of the places they wanted to roll this out first was in Grand Rapids. I don't know that Betsy DeVos was behind that, but I wouldn't be surprised with that. It was rolled out in Grand Rapids, which, if you know that city, is a flourishing city, really prosperous in the western part of the state. Then they were trying to export it to Detroit. It just kind of came and went rather quietly, and I don't know enough about why that was, except to say that we all breathed a sigh of relief in Michigan with the fact that it didn't get more traction here. But again, you know, what I think we see on the part of teacher educators is the power of the pen, the ability to try to use research and our professional voices to support teachers. Nevertheless, we're very concerned here because we worry about teachers and the replacement of teachers in schools across Michigan. You know, although as a post-industrial state, one of the things we're also seeing, a declining number of students overall in schools and a declining population. But it is an effort, and we come together in an organization like the one in Iowa. This ours is called MACD, and other mechanisms to get teacher educators together to try to push back, to do blogging, to do things that raise issues of equity and achievement of the problems of urban schools, and when we can use our research, the research of others in educational policy in another department in our college, to try to push back against some of what we see as misguided, as Michigan's got an aspirational statement espoused by the Michigan Department of Education called Top 10 in 10, because like Iowa, one point this state was in the top 10 in terms of literacy and numeracy and other measures of student performance, and has just slipped terribly in the last 10 or 15 years. So some of what I saw being introduced in Iowa, like an emphasis on third grade reading and holding students back if they don't pass their tests, now have been legislated here in the state of Michigan. And so we have literacy professors who are just trying to use their voices, participate in hearing sessions with legislatures, lobby, do whatever they can to suggest that this is not good policy. This is going to create ends that will never get Michigan top 10 and 10. So, you know, you do what you can, and you work with teachers to try to keep them not demoralized and interested in how satisfying and knowledgeable about how satisfying teaching can be, because it is, as you know, Dora Santora and others say, it's good work. It can be really satisfying, even though it feels tough on certain days to be doing it.
Well, there is so much more we can talk about, as you just said, but the idea that teacher educators, typically in academia, though, have moved, you know, even me, moving the busted pencils, doing what I can to get the word out, you know, writing the blogs, taking the research, you know, Kevin Kumashera, you mentioned in that book, you know, going off on his own, trying to create that principled resistance. I mean, and that's what we have to do. We can go on, but Professor Krakow, what we say here is, you have truly busted pencils.
What an honor. Thanks, Tim.
Thank you.
Feels like we landed in the Twilight Zone.
Time for another edition of Cone Zone with education guru Alfie Cone. Personal or personalized education? Take it away, Alfie.
There's a big difference between personal and personalized, just like there's a difference between, sentiment and sentimentality. These are not the same thing. It's when it's not personal in any meaningful sense that you have to buy some device or bit of software that creates this artificial personalization. Personal learning means you work with each kid to create projects of discovery that reflect the kid's unique needs and interests. That requires the presence of a caring teacher who knows each student. Personalized learning means you adjust the difficulty level of prefabricated skills-based exercises, usually based on the kid's test scores, and that requires software. Mm. See the difference?
Yeah, well, but I don't know if you saw it was out 2 days ago in The Telegraph by Henry Bodkin. And this put this in, but it's the title, and it's in their science section, Inspirational Robots, Replacing Teachers Within 10 Years. And of course, this is coming from Sir Anthony Seldon, the Vice Chancellor at the University of Buckingham.
They've given away the game then. It's just like, how much does Uber care about you drivers, given that most of their profits are being diverted to creating autonomous cars?
Right.
How much does Amazon care about you workers, given that they're working on robots to put you out of work? So this is the end game in education as well, which we're already seeing signs of with these online courses that have horrible results, even using stupid measures like test scores.
So, okay, we're going to leave inspirational robots alone for this point and not move them to the personalized learning. And, but as we talk about that, though, in the teacher education business, I'm wondering if there's a job for a dean of helping program these inspirational robot teachers.
You're already worried about your own job, and you're the president.
Yeah. I'm not the president. I take orders from the president. I still serve at the pleasure of the president.
Yeah, no, I mean the dean. Sorry.
No,
yeah.
I know.
It seems like such an obvious thing to say, and people nod, of course, when I say it, that the question we need to ask is what kind of learning should be taking place in those schools. Ask that first, then ask, is tech useful?
Right.
But it's a radical question because, I think that there's some forms of technology that can help kids make stuff.
Sure.
Help them create and produce. Yeah, that sounds fine, and especially if it's happening collaboratively. But far more common for ed tech is, to tart up a lecture with a smart board.
Right.
Or look up facts online, or rehearse skills with a adaptive learning system, or, write answers to the teacher's questions and upload them to Google Docs. None of that advances education at all.
Well, it changes. It's like a small change in the medium, and to me, that's it. There's really no, whether it's a whiteboard, a chalkboard, or a smart board.
And you've got all these educators who are like becoming sexually aroused over this stuff. They are so excited by anything that is, digital and cutting edge and uses this stuff. And they're not realizing that this is really all this amazing distraction. It's so much noise that is locking us deeper into an old-fashioned, inadequate model of education. It doesn't, the classroom doesn't become one bit more student-centered because you've got some cutesy software. You've got a, you know, smart board, dumb curriculum, in effect.
Maybe that's the way we should be talking about it, though, just like you just said, is student-centered, because I think a lot of teachers, first glance, when they get jazzed about personalized learning, as you just said, first of all, I think they imagine personal learning. They think it's some form of student-centeredness that has some roots to some kind of Dewey idea. And when I ask them about what's actually happening collaboratively with the students and they talk about, well, you know, plugging them in, I then ask them to reflect back and say, is that student-centered? Or,
yeah,
you know,
that's right.
You know,
and the answer is usually no, as a result of anything that we're calling personalized learning. In fact, the whole need to personalize probably comes from this transmission model of learning in the first place. You know, if the whole point is to just dump facts into kids, well, then sure, some cute device might help teachers become more efficient at the style and rate of dumping.
Sure,
but
because
if the point is to help them understand ideas from the inside out, then what they're doing is already personal, and it doesn't have to be artificially personalized.
But that's the real key there, is recognizing, do we really want, and this is the question for a long time, not just with digital machines, but any, as you said, a transmission model of education. Which
right.
one are we using? If it's transmission, and if it's an iPad or if it's a Blackboard, it's the same darn thing.
That's right. That's exactly right. But we're blinded by how much fun some of these devices are.
Alfie really laid out personalized learning. I wonder what Matt Damon's mom thinks about it.
Wait, what? You want to know what my mom would say? All right, well, just ask.
You know, all of this talk about technology and the emphasis on it and all the money put towards it and all and the whole and the idea that you've got to give an iPad to every student in the first grade and keep up with the other school that's doing that. Really, you know, the whole thing is snake oil, because no study, not that personally I don't feel that I need a study to tell me this, but there isn't any study or any research or any evidence anywhere that using any of this technology, iPads or computers, smartphones or any of it, improves the quality of learning for kids. What it does is it distracts people from the deeper, more important, serious issues in education that we have to be thinking about. It makes everybody think if you get these tools, you're going to actually improve education, but it just isn't true. Not that there isn't a place for technology, because I think there is, but it's just been completely overblown and exaggerated in terms of the role that it can have. But sure, there's some situations where you'd have some blended learning that you might choose for a specific situation, a specific student, specific circumstance. For me, it would only be like high school kids, because I wouldn't want to see, I don't like to see any kind of online learning for any younger children. But anytime you do that, though, you're trading off. You might accomplish a certain kind of learning that might have value for a specific situation. But you're also taking away then the opportunity for group learning or for learning in context, collaborative learning. And it gets us to this question of what are schools really for? Because they aren't places just to learn specific skills and concepts. They're also places where we learn to get along with other people, to make decisions as a group. We learn citizenship skills that are going to help young people become participating citizens in a democracy when they grow up. The school has a much wider purpose and a role in society and in students and children's lives than just simply getting answers to questions.
This is Matt Damon on Busted Pencils Radio. Please stop bothering me and just ask my mom already.
Time now for our weekly salute to legendary historian and activist Howard Zinn. This is your moment of Zen.
And in such a world of conflict, a world of victims and executioners, it is the job of the thinking people, as Albert Camus suggested, not to be on the side of the executioners.
My thanks to Alfie Cohn, Matt's mom, and especially Professor Margaret Smith Crocco. I'm Dr. Tim Slecker. Keep busting pencils.
Log on to BustedPencils.com for the latest trending news, blogs, past shows, and more. Subscribe to our podcast in iTunes and Google Play. And get daily updates by following us on Facebook and Twitter at Busted Pencils. This is Fully Leaded Education Talk, Busted Pencils Radio.